Network Europe, a partnership of the continent's leading international broadcasters. Hello, Nick Champeau here, and a warm welcome to this edition of Network Europe. Coming up in the program, World Cup fever fuels positive patriotism in Germany. Paris's Quai Branly Indigenous Art Museum, a symbol of diversity in an age of globalization. Elections in Slovakia, the left won, but it needs partners badly. We'll talk about Wednesday's summit between Bush and EU leaders in Vienna. And still on transatlantic relations, can Warsaw gain more out of its relations with the US? So stay tuned. First, football. As I'm pretty sure you all know by now, the Football World Cup is in full swing in Germany right now. Teams from 32 countries have been battling it out on the playing field in international football's biggest event. The German squad qualified for the second round easily, and the Germans are very proud to play host country, so the mood there is one of celebration. And one aspect of that appears to be the development of what is being called positive patriotism. An odd expression, I know, but in Germany, where patriotism has been viewed with much suspicion since the end of World War II, it marks a real change in attitude. Deutsche Welle's Carl James reports from Berlin.
The World Cup has set off an explosion of fun and good cheer in Germany. The tournament seems to be putting to rest the stereotype of the dour, killjoy German, as John Sweetlick, a 22-year-old American who came over for the contest, found out.
We were in Munich for the Germany-Poland game, and it was probably one of the best times I've ever had watching a game, so it was awesome. They can party.
They love their beer.
And they also seem to love their flag. It's everywhere these days, attached to cars, hanging off apartment balconies, draped around the shoulders of fans, or painted on their faces. The entire country is awash in a sea of black, red, and gold. Not that unusual, you might think. People in many countries love to see their flag and hang it on their walls or fly it from their houses. In Germany, though, it's a little different.
But in Germany, it's very unusual. I've never seen Germans running through the streets with national flags in their hands.
That's Günter Gebauer, a professor at Berlin's Free University who studies sociology and sports.
My generation, I was born just in the last year of the World War, has been educated in the sense that we despise or avoid national symbols as the flag and national anthem, and we have been educated not to say, I'm proud of my country.
So for a generation of Germans, hearing the national anthem didn't inspire reverence, rather a vague unease. For them, any expression of patriotism was linked to the Nazi era, when Germany's aggressive nationalism sparked a world war and the Holocaust. Most people suspected that those who flew the flag to be a little too far to the right politically. Left-wing parliamentarian Christian Strubele of the Green Party says he was appalled when he first saw flags mounted on cars for this World Cup, although he adds he's not completely against flying the flag. It just depends on how the national colors are used.
I just have something against it when I see some who let it go to their heads, and then we see the eagle on the flag, and then they begin having nationalistic feelings, or even singing nationalistic songs. Then I just turn away.
But those waving the flag today seem mostly in the mood just to have a good time and have little concern for a resurgent nationalism. Tina Britt is a 40-year-old from Stuttgart. She was on the so-called fan mile, where huge TV screens have been set up where crowds follow the football games. Her son was waving a flag.
It's a little strange for me, too. I used to see it differently. But since it doesn't have to do with national pride, but is just an expression of fun and enjoyment, that's okay. And of course we want to get behind our national team.
Passage of time plays a role in the loss of discomfort over the flag as well. 20-year-old Sebastian Tienelt has one wrapped around his waist. For him, the crimes of the Nazis are something in history books, nothing to do with his everyday life.
Ja, ich meine, das hat ja damit nichts mit der Geschichte damals zu tun. It doesn't have anything to do with that part of our history. It's about something else, and anyway, the war was 60 years ago. We have to get over that at some point.
Commentators point to several other possible reasons for the change in public sentiment regarding national symbols. There's been something of a morale boost in Germany. And then there's the German team, which has been performing better on the field than expected. They've progressed to the second stage of the tournament. For Michael Sontheimer, a historian of contemporary Germany, the recent flag-waving is a sign of Germans developing a more straightforward relationship with their symbols, like in other countries. He says it's a step toward normality.
I would be worried if people would forget about the Holocaust, about Nazi Germany, but I don't think that having a national flag means that you say, oh, Hitler wasn't so bad, or oh, it was just a little accident, we don't talk about it anymore. So I think you can have both. You can have a sort of patriotism with the national symbols, and you can have a critical view on the German past as well.
And who knows if this burst of patriotism is long-lasting. Once the visitors have gone home, the stadiums are empty, and the summer sun has disappeared behind gray clouds, those German flags might be put away until the next big event at home. For Deutsche Welle Radio, I'm Kyle James in Berlin.
And now to Paris. Okay, it's not as fun as the World Cup, but French President Jacques Chirac inaugurated the Quai Branly Indigenous Art Museum in the capital on Tuesday. Like François Mitterrand, who gave Paris the Louvre Pyramid, the 235 million euro museum is Chirac's legacy to the city in the final year of his presidency. Now, beyond the post-colonial angst over the concept of a museum devoted to what used to be called primitive art and is now called indigenous art, what is the Quai Branly like as a space to visit? And are the exhibits the stars of the show, or is it the work of Jean Nouvel, the museum's architect, that takes the prize? Radio France International's Hannah Godfrey reports.
As one penetrates into the exhibition space through a leather-clad snaking corridor, which is supposed to represent a river flowing through the museum, and emerges into a darkened space filled with strange and powerful objects from distant civilizations, one senses that this space makes claims on the visitor at a profound level. The museum is surrounded by a garden marking the end of Paris and the beginning of elsewhere. The windows of the building are shrouded by translucent forest stencils. The air is filled with the heady smell of leather. There are boxes dotted over the museum where selected artefacts are presented in a particularly intimate context. One of these spaces is a cave into which just two people can enter at a time. As the museum's architect Jean Nouvel explains, this is not a classical exhibition space.
I did not create a building, I created a territory. And this territory is with a big garden, and this big garden, that was a creative transition between our world and their world. I wanted to create a house for these objects. It's not artworks, it's objects linked to this civilization, linked to different trusts, to different gods, to different way to live.
But does the visitor who's unfamiliar with the often potent significance of these objects learn to read the language of these artefacts? Or does the half-light and the jungle theme just reinforce colonial ideas about an impenetrable heart of darkness beyond Western civilization? Reza Azar, who worked with Jean Nouvel on the scenography of the museum.
We are not in a purely anthropological museum. Our role is not uniquely to explain the sociological meaning of the exhibits. The most important thing is the emotion that the objects evolve, which is linked to their magical quality.
Some visitors seem to feel that information about the exhibits was rather minimal, but there's a multimedia space and an extensive library in the Quai Branly where the curious can find out all they wish to know. To summarise, the ego of the museum's architect takes up attention which should be devoted to the objects that the space was designed to honour.
The architect is putting himself in front and not the museum as a museum. He's like most of the architects, you know, he's full of himself. And the boxes he put on the side, some of them are absolutely ridiculous. The showcases are made in such a way that you have the angle. When you enter in, the first thing you see, you have the angle. And so you cannot see the object.
Whether you're seduced or outraged by the museum and its layout, the Quai Branly doesn't leave the visitor indifferent. And the project certainly doesn't lack ambition. even though some of the ideas that went into its making could be judged to be of another age. This is Hannah Godfrey for RFI.
You're listening to Network Europe. Time now for a Briefing from Brussels series. This week, Stephen Castle focuses on relations between Washington and Brussels as U.S. President George W. Bush met with EU leaders in Vienna on Wednesday.
The last U.S. president to visit Austria was Jimmy Carter, who came to Vienna back in 1979 to negotiate a nuclear arms deal with the Soviets. This week, the city welcomed George W. Bush for an EU-US summit. Though welcome is hardly the word that would be used by the 6,000 demonstrators on the city's streets. Yet even they wouldn't deny the importance of the relationship between the EU and the US. Together, they account for almost 40% of world trade. And last year, Europe exported goods to America, which earned it 250 billion euros. As many as 14 million jobs are dependent on transatlantic investment. And every day, 1.7 billion euros of trade in goods and services takes place between Europe and the world's only superpower. Little wonder that, by the time President Bush descended the steps of Air Force One for his first ever visit to Austria, diplomats had produced a raft of prepackaged agreements to demonstrate the strength of the relationship. Well, EU-US summits have never been renowned for their spontaneity. A formal declaration promised to cooperate in dealings with energy suppliers such as Russia. It announced joint teams to find and seize counterfeit goods, and it called for a joint panel on climate change and clean energy, an issue over which the two sides have barely been on speaking terms. There was a common line on tackling threats posed by North Korea and a nuclear-armed Iran. At a press conference in the ornate Hofburg Palace, President Bush was backed by the EU when he warned the North Koreans not to test long-range missiles. The EU agreed, too, that Iran should not delay its response to an offer from the West over its nuclear program. Unfortunately, European public opinion remains unconvinced by these displays of unity. One opinion poll shows that most Europeans see the US as a bigger threat to global peace than Iran. That idea was described as absurd by the president when he was challenged at a press conference. Nevertheless, public opinion made it impossible to ignore the legacy of the Iraq War and the issues that strain the transatlantic link. Mr. Bush preempted the Europeans by raising himself Guantanamo Bay, the U.S. detention camp on the island of Cuba. He said that he, too, wants to close it and gave more detail on how it might be emptied. Wolfgang Schüssel, the Austrian chancellor who chaired the meeting, called on the Americans to relax their visa regime for Europeans. At present, travelers from 10 EU countries cannot take part in America's visa waiver scheme. If that is not changed, EU countries could impose visas on U.S. diplomats and military personnel. Nevertheless, Europeans were pleased by President Bush's tone, and the event passed off smoothly. The pre-negotiated declaration issued, Air Force One was airborne and heading for Hungary. The truth is that most of Europe will never learn to love President Bush. The EU's leaders know they have to learn to live with him. This is Stephen Castle in Brussels.
And following the Vienna summit, George W. Bush visited Budapest on the 50th anniversary of the Hungarian uprising against communism. Commentators have noted that Bush's trips to Europe often include a stop in Eastern Europe's new democracies. The U.S. administration has decided to station forces in Bulgaria and Romania. Hungarian troops helped in Iraq after the March 2003 invasion. Romania, Bulgaria, and Poland also joined the coalition. But it seems that these countries suffer from a sense of frustration and believe they have not been sufficiently repaid. For instance, Poland's hopes to land contracts in the reconstruction of Iraq have not yet materialized. Radio Polonia's Bogdan Jarin reports.
In a spectacular turnaround, the majority of Poles are now against this country's participation in the stabilization mission in Iraq. But so far, public outcry for a quick return home of roughly 2,500 Polish soldiers has done nothing to make the Polish government change its mind. Warsaw has pledged to remain in Iraq till the end of the year. Political analyst Robert Strabel from the Polish-American Journal argues that Washington may have fallen short in fulfilling economic and political pledges of support.
From a maximum standpoint, the United States did fall short of keeping its pledges to Poland. I think Poland is done right by not being swallowed up entirely by the Brussels bureaucracy and it kind of being a Euro-Atlantic advocate within the European Union. This gives it certain leverage, certain political, certain perhaps even moral leverage, which I think is cannot be translated into dollars and cents.
There are those who think that Poland may have miscalculated its position on Iraq. Krzysztof Bobiński from the Polish Institute of International Affairs thinks that Warsaw seemed too anxious to side with the U.S.
I think that when the Polish government decided to go into Iraq, I think that it thought that there would be much more of a fruitful economic relationship with the United States. I think they were thinking in terms of much greater levels of inward investment from the United States, transfer of technology and so on. I think this was maybe over-optimistic because decisions about investment in Poland or in any country are taken on commercial grounds, and if American companies thought that Poland was a good investment prospect, then they would have invested anyway.
But it's not all bad news. Poland's arms industry has been given a shot in the arm due to its involvement in Iraq. Robert Strabel from the Polish-American Journal says that Warsaw has put itself on the front line for a reason. It is now getting lucrative arms contracts with countries like Indonesia and the Philippines.
Poland's arms industry is booming right now because of its military hardware presence in Iraq. And I understand that Bumar, which is the biggest company producing Polish weaponry, sold $1 billion worth of things to the other countries, which is a tenfold increase over the past 4 years. And, of course, if Poland had not been in Iraq, if no one had seen Polish equipment being used there, probably these orders would not be forthcoming.
Polish Foreign Minister Anna Fotyga, on her first official visit to the U.S., reaffirmed Poland's commitment to strong ties with the United States. But according to Krzysztof Babinski from the Polish Institute of International Affairs, Poland has yet to find out a thing or two about how to deal with the Americans.
First of all, you have to learn to negotiate with the Americans. Poland hasn't learned that yet. Poland was a bit too starry-eyed at the beginning. And secondly, I think Poland should really take a greater interest in the outside world. Poland should be thinking in global terms, and it's still very much a parochial country, and therefore that isn't happening.
Indeed, Warsaw appears determined to be a global player with a strong voice of its own. But it may take some time before it manages to be actually seen as one.
Radio Polonia's Bogdan Jaren. And now let's head to Slovakia for a report on the outcome of last weekend's elections. Radio Slovakia's Peter Mailer reports from Bratislava.
Slovak voters gave the left-wing opposition Smer Party the largest margin of victory in 12 years. Smer leader Robert Fico's steady criticism of the right-of-centre government of Mikuláš Zurinda brought him the victory. Tuesday, Fico was authorised to form the new government by President Ivan Gasparovic. The constitution states that parliament must meet within 30 days after a general election, and Gasparovic wants to call the first session on July the 12th. This is all very straightforward. However, what is not as yet quite so straightforward is who Fico's coalition partners will be. It is this question that is taxing the pundits. If Smer leads negotiations, it could form coalitions made up of Smer, the nationalist SNS, the Christian Democrats KDH. Another option is a Smer-SNS-HZDS coalition with 85 seats in Parliament. And which way is Fico thinking? Well, it seems at the moment that he is choosing the easiest option, and one that many in the business and diplomatic fields fear. A coalition between the HZDS of Vladimir Mečiar and nationalist SNS with its arrogant leader, Jan Slotter. A Nový čas daily commentary earlier in the week made the point that Slovakia probably hasn't had ideal governments over the last 8 years, but Zurinda's terms in office were literally heaven compared to the 1994-98 period when Mečiar and Slotter sat together at the coalition council. Fitzo, by taking this course of action, would also be rejecting criticism, widely reported in the media, from European socialists regarding the cooperation of Smer and the nationalists.
Radio Slovakia's Peter Miller reporting from Bratislava. To Sweden now for something completely different. Dogma, a school of filmmaking in Denmark, had worldwide success with filmmakers such as Lars von Trier reaping international fame. Now, a group of filmmakers, scriptwriters, and producers in Gothenburg is trying to do just the same by creating Sweden's first cinema manifesto. They call themselves Doris Film, and their goal is to increase the number of films directed by women in Sweden. Radio Sweden's Moira Sullivan caught up with Annika Hellström and Annika Eriksson at a special Women in Film and Television event at the Swedish Film Institute, and she asked them how it all started.
We were a couple of female film workers in Gothenburg who were kind of fed up with the stereotype roles you see in movies and television, and so we decided that we wanted to form a network to try to explore if it has to look this way, both for female and male stereotypes. And so we were some women, we met, and the one decision we made was there ain't going to be any whining among us, that we had to have fun and we had to find the humor among us. So we set up, when we discussed what name should we have, we thought of Doris and Doris Day. And she might not be the lead role that you want to look for, but, you know, it makes you warm in your heart and it makes you smile. So we thought Doris was a good name. That's how it came up.
This is a cinema manifesto. Were you at all inspired by Dogma?
Yeah, in fact, we were. So we thought we'd write a women's manifesto. And I think it's a world first manifesto for equality in film.
And what are those musts in the cinema manifesto for Doris?
Well, the musts are four, and the first one is that all script should be written by women, and all leading role should be played by a woman, and that all the leading functions in the production should be held by women, and also that the composers should be a woman.
You're going to have a feature film competition that, with the manuscript deadline for August 15th in any format. One of the directors said that for her it was a political decision or a political choice to want to have all women in all positions, but some of the directors expressed that it wasn't always easy. How do you feel about that, that the Doris films will be made with a technical crew and primarily by women?
I feel that's one of the primary things that challenge me and that inspires me to work in a kind of a production like this, to find women in all leading parts and in all function in the production. For me, that's inspiring. So for me, that's not at all a problem. I think it's fun.
Doris Film is already getting international attention because of this wonderful program you both have started.
And the Doris Manifest has also started up in Norway. So we're going abroad.
And thanks to Radio Sweden for this interview. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of Network Europe. If you would like to comment, please visit our new website, www.networkeurope.org. We'll leave you with Latino German music. Yes, it exists. And I'm not hinting that Brazil and Germany will meet in the World Cup finals. It's just a coincidence. The music is by Senior Coconut, and this song is called Behind the Mask. From me, Nick Champeau, have a wonderful weekend. Bye-bye.
This program is produced with support from the European Commission.